Look, well, thanks everyone for coming along. Firstly, I'd just like to acknowledge that we meet on Ngunnawal land and pay my respects to the elders past and present. Secondly, my name's Kevin and I'm just the ACT Fabians, one of the ACT Fabians people here in the ACT. And tonight we have a very exciting topic and a very exciting speaker. We have Professor Barbara Norman here, head of the Urban and Regional Planning, that must be department or whatnot, unit? Oh.
Program,
discipline at the University of Canberra. She's also the chair of the ACT Climate Change Council and a former national chair of the Australian Fabians. So we're very glad, very proud to have her back. And she will be discussing tonight how should cities respond to climate change, discussing the role that urban planning can play in helping to address the challenges of climate change and increasing urbanisation and what cities such as Canberra should do. So that was read just straight off the flyer, so I think you should all already know that. And without further ado, I think I'll throw it to Professor Barbara Norman.
And we're being recorded, in fact.
And we're being recorded by 2XX, I believe. So, very exciting night for the Fabians. First time, long time we've had.
So get your questions ready. Go to air. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Kevin, and thanks very much for inviting me tonight. I am the past national chair, and I had that role when I was in Melbourne. Fabians is pretty active in Melbourne under someone you should all be aware of. That's Race Matthews. And he's played an enormous role with the Fabian Society, and it's a great privilege and honour for me to be a chair for a period of time. I moved back to Canberra about 2.5 years ago and to take up this chair of urban and regional planning at UC, and it's been a very interesting and challenging opportunity, and I'm happy to talk about that later, but an exciting one. So thank you first, and right at the beginning, I also would like to acknowledge the Indigenous people of this land, both past and present. Quite often I give a PowerPoint presentation, but tonight this is a bit like an old-fashioned town hall speech, so bear with me, I haven't given one of these for a while, but it was actually very refreshing to sit down and write it. So thanks again for the opportunity. So the focus of this talk, as was in the flyer, is the twin challenges of urbanisation and climate change and the role of cities in responding to climate change. I think my work, someone called me a prac-ademic the other day. My background's about 20 years in practice in different jurisdictions in Australia and in Canberra, and about 10 years in the university sector. So I bring a bit of a mix to this. And I think that given this topic, urbanisation, urban planning, cities and climate change, I hope that my background actually has something to contribute. I like to think across boundaries, and Simon Crean uses that phrase. In fact, I've been accused of giving it to him at some point, joining the dots. So while discussions between nations on this topic, and I was recently in Rio 20, may appear to be slow around climate change and our expanding cities around urbanisation and sustainable development generally. And I know there was fairly negative press here over that period of Rio Plus 20. I'll be arguing this evening over the next 30 minutes at the most, plenty of time for discussion, that there is actually considerable action at the regional and city level. And that this activity and innovation needs to be harnessed and supported at the national level. It also needs to be placed in the broader context of sustainable development. That's what I hope would have been reported back here in the national press from the Rio 20 discussions. That's what actually happened there, and I'll talk to you about that experience. But it's not what actually was reported back in this press, unfortunately. And you'll probably know why. So at the outset, can I say this is the urban century. This is why I'm interested in this, and this is why I think all of you should be interested. With over 60% of the world's population living in cities by 2050, trending to 90% living in cities by the end of the century, the urban century. The UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, declared at Rio Plus 20 that sustainability should be through our towns and cities. New York Mayor Bloomberg, chair of C40, the Global Cities Alliance, tackling climate change, added, as cities become more sustainable, our entire world will reap the rewards. Arnold Schwarzenegger, when governor of California, extended this concept to regions by establishing Regions 20, regions of climate change, And anyone knows anything about me, I always talk about the regional context. One of my students is at the back there and can attest to that. The Climate Commission in Australia has confirmed that the impacts of climate change are already with us. In its report, The Critical Decade, 2011, lead author Will Steffen at ANU heads up the Climate Institute. The Commission confirms that the global climate is changing and humanity is almost surely the dominant cause. Aye. Furthermore, this is the critical decade. Decisions we make from now to 2020 will determine the severity of climate change our children and grandchildren experience. The IPCC report on extreme weather, which was published November 2011, concludes that settlement patterns, urbanisation, and changes in socioeconomic conditions have all influenced observed trends in exposure and vulnerability to climate extremes. And they state that with their category high confidence. So they're very, very confident about that. So that's the nexus. That's the connection, settlement patterns, urbanisation and climate change, as reported by the IPCC. So what we do in cities matters. And how we plan and build our cities will be critical to our global and local responses to climate change. International action and agreements, such as the conversations at Rio 20, between nation states on this issue is variable, and we saw that. However, at the city and regional level, as I suggested at the beginning, there is much activity. And I want this to be a positive speech, and I'm doing this for a purpose. The OECD has recognised this in a series of publications over the last 2 years, and if you're interested in this space, I recommend them strongly to you, on climate change, cities, and most recently on green growth. Possibly the most active and resourced activity is the C40 Alliance, in partnership with the Clinton Climate Initiative, chaired by New York Mayor Bloomberg. C40 is a network of megacities committed to addressing climate change. It currently has 58 members across the globe, including Sydney and Melbourne, and is a global network supporting and highlighting action on climate change. Current examples range from a new environmental rating program for buildings in Tokyo, Bogota's comprehensive bike network, the City of Melbourne's Council House, car-free days in Seoul. Wouldn't that be a great idea here? Can you imagine? I think that's a good idea. We should do that. Car-free days in Seoul, an effective energy efficiency program in Berlin, and New York City plan to reduce emissions by 30% by 2017. In visiting the mayor's office in New York City, and I had the privilege to do that not so long ago, I was impressed with his commitment to evaluation and monitoring of the significant suite of actions being implemented there. New York City has one of the lowest carbon footprints in the world and is leading action at the local level. The second significant example on the international stage to do with cities and climate change is the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, ICLEIA, and some of you would be familiar with this. Was very strong in Australia, seems to have waned. I think it's on its way back. Almost complementing the megacity network, ICLEIA is a global alliance of city mayors of towns and smaller cities across the globe. It hosted a major conference in Brazil in Belo Horizonte in the lead up to Rio 20, in which I participated. The atmosphere of that meeting was very positive. It was very positive. It was such a contrast to the conversations happening in Rio that I saw later on, where, unencumbered by the restrictions between nation states and international dialogue, cities had a very positive view about sharing knowledge, sharing experience, sharing practice, and being strengthened through that. That's why I think cities may well be the future in relation to climate change. Confirmed for me that much of the action on climate change would be led by cities. However, as was made clear in the communique from ICLEIA to Rio 20, cities cannot achieve such transformation on their own. Which brings me to Rio 20. This was not a climate change meeting as such, and some people got a bit confused about that, but really a stock take on how we are travelling on the broader agenda of sustainable development. Clearly, responding to climate change is part of that agenda. Despite the pessimistic national press on the outcomes, the actual text, and I really recommend you look at the actual text, the final text, reflected a more progressive outcome for cities. The one issue that developed and developing nations agreed on was the need to establish a process for more sustainable cities, including integrated urban planning. Now, another past role I have was National President of the Planning Institute of Australia. I think we've been arguing as the planning profession for possibly 20 years for integrated urban planning. And I haven't really quite got that on the national agenda here, although under this government it's more there than has ever been before, except maybe in the Whitlam years. But here it was in the international text suddenly. Australia went to Rio 20 on the oceans agenda, and actually coastal planning is my particular expertise, so that was very laudable. But the rest of the world went on the urban agenda. And that's something I think that possibly was missed in the national press back here. But I was really, really pleased to see integrated urban planning in the international arena and in the international text. Australian Prime Minister came, and one of the outcomes of her attendance is that and again, I don't think this has been reported much, the Australian Prime Minister will co-chair a high-level forum to guide that process. Nice to see more of that, maybe, than the asylum seekers in the national place. Both are important, of course. So, what's all this mean for Australian cities? In a similar pattern to the international scene, there is significant innovation and action by cities on climate change within Australia. Although I have to say, the political landscape is rapidly changing, and I'm very happy to talk about that. And I gave an interview on the radio very recently about that, where I clipped Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland on the ear about the unravelling of planning and climate change policy. I've never seen it happen so quickly in recent months. And then I went to the beach, I think, and hid. But we'll come back to that. So in a similar pattern, putting that aside, there is great innovation happening at the local level across this country. I suggest this is because local government and regional organisations understand that action on climate change, and this is a key point that I'd like to make, is not only good for our planetary future, but has multiple other benefits for the community. In other words, many of the actions we would consider for climate change mitigation and adaptation, we would consider as beneficial to the community and leading practice in sustainable development. To illustrate, I will highlight five themes this evening. And there are more, of course, but time permits only that. Green buildings, active living, public transport, open space for adaptation and community engagement. So firstly, green buildings. What do we mean by green buildings? Well, green buildings in this context is very much about reducing energy consumption. So retrofitting and reducing energy consumption in public and commercial buildings. Now, given Canberra's history, I could see enormous potential for this. If there's any city in this country that has public buildings, it's Canberra. Public buildings and commercial buildings. Public lighting is a really important contributor to this, or you can make very significant inroads. Ensuring planning includes environmental performance in the codes, information and advice to community members on what options there are, and as an example, and I'll give practical examples for each of these, so it's not just words. The best example, I think, right now is the 1,200 buildings program in Melbourne, in the City of Melbourne. City of Melbourne have set up something called the Sustainable Fund, partnered with industry, identified 1,200 buildings in the CBD that are eligible for this scheme, open to change, open to being able to reduce energy consumption, and most importantly, they've provided finance, a financing mechanism to help in partnership with industry to make that change. So I think that that's a really practical. And that's actually being looked at right around the world, what they're doing there. And the second part to that, at the national level, we have something called the Green Buildings Council, which is very much about industry trying to work out what they can be doing in this space. Industry actually gets it in this space, in commercial buildings. The leading industry does, because they've already worked out that there's a premium they can now charge for rent. You know, maybe for, you know, not green environmental reasons, but there's actually a commercial advantage to be going green these days. And you're beginning to see advertising signs around, we are a green building. There's some issues there about what we call greenwash, whether they're actually green buildings, but it's good to see that the trend is in that direction anyway. The second one is public transport. And in Canberra, we've had a long, and continuing, long conversation about public transport, particularly around light rail and connecting possibly with a very fast train. I'm on the public record as being a supporter of light rail. You may have a different view. I think it's one of those transformational changes we could make in Canberra, particularly up Northbourne Avenue, perhaps connecting our universities, perhaps connecting the airport, perhaps connecting to a very fast train. So one day. So public transport, but my main point is investing in public transport is critical to getting people out of cars into public transport, but it has to be good, it has to be efficient, it has to be a service that people want. And a very good example, I think, of investing in rail, there's two very good examples in Australia to point to, at least, but two ones that I'll mention. One is investment in regional rail in regional Victoria over the last 10 years under the former Labor governments there, and the faster regional rail that was, not very fast, faster. I think they chose that word carefully in Victoria. I was in Victoria at the time. But the benefit to regional Victoria and the regional growth, not just because of investment in regional rail, but it was a very important part of the equation, has been significant in Victoria and demonstrated. So I think that's a very successful model. The other has been building the rail, extending it from Perth to Mandurah, and very significant development as a result of that. And so investing in public transport, moving people from one mode to the other is obviously key to any response by cities to climate change. The third is, and you may wonder, why am I mentioning this? The third is what I call active living. Well, it's not actually my phrase. It's a phrase by the National Heart Foundation, and they're running this program, and I think particularly in Canberra, they're running it very successfully. It's innovative. It's about investing in safe bicycle and pedestrian networks, but it's not only that. It's about good neighbourhood planning. It's about reducing the journey to work. And I'd like to throw in a new idea, some term I've just made up, or maybe I read it somewhere, so I better be careful not to claim it my own. Smart local hubs. I'd like to start to see smart local hubs in our neighbourhoods in this town. You're probably wondering what this has got to do with climate change. It's got to do with reducing that journey to work. When we look at these issues, we can't look at them in isolation. We need to look at our demography, for example, in this place. Now, I don't know about you. Depends how old you are. Seems to be a lot of my friends are retiring right now. Much older, of course. But at least 10 years older. But they're retiring. Very smart, very switched on, don't necessarily want to live at home. If they don't work at a university, they may not have a place to go and share their ideas, work with technology. Wouldn't it be great to have those kind of hubs in some of our not very thriving neighbourhood centres in Canberra? See, this is about connecting the dots. That's where Simon Creed's got it right. Adaptation, the fourth point. Coastal planning is my background. So local coastal councils adopting adaptation policy, sea level planning policies, setbacks and open space for storm surge. Again, City of Mandurah, WA is doing a great job there. But there's also a project in this town that we're leading. UC, I'm actually the chief investigator, ANU and University of Wollongong, where the three universities have come together to look at coastal urban futures for townships, coastal townships, from Wollongong to Lakes Entrance, that whole southeast corner. And we're working together as a team, and I think it's a very exciting project. Won't be finished till next March, so I can't tell you the results, but maybe I could come back and share them another time. So those coastal towns are not under great pressure today, but will be in the future. We're starting to look at what kind of policies could be put in place, working with focus groups, working with the councils, working with the communities, three universities working together to try and look at coastal futures in the context of climate change. And then fifthly, engagement with the community. I argue that as we are planning possibly for more risk and uncertainty in the context of climate change, planning for our urban futures, we need more engagement, not less. More engagement, not less. And I say that bravely because as a planner, I've been to many, many, many community meetings over my life, whether they've been angry farmers or city people. But I'm definitely of the view, at this stage in my life, we must have extensive community engagement. Probably the best example to point you to there is, I think, the one that was at the Mornington Peninsula Council called Conversations on Climate Change. And it subsequently won quite a few national awards. So if you're interested in sort of leading practice in this space, I would commend it to you. they were quite brave in their own way. What they did was say, this is the international science on climate change. This is the national science or interpretation of. We'll put that on the table. But in fact, coming to your neighbourhood, we're not actually sure what it might be for you here. Why don't you tell us what you think might happen from your history, your knowledge, your experience of your community and your space and your place? And that's where the community said, ah, that's a good question. That's a better question than coming along and just telling us what is. So I really do recommend that to you. Three, four, getting there. So Canberra. The national capital is unique, as you know, in structure, design and governance. Its history, planning and development are under scrutiny leading up to the centenary of Canberra next year. Capithetical, which some of you may have heard of, and I would forgive you if many of you haven't, but you should become aware of it. It's an international design competition between the ACT government and the Institute of Architects are hosting. And I hope it will bring many ideas of inspiration to the table. It's an international design competition. What would a national capital look like today, given the changes? I'm very privileged to be chair of that judging panel, and I've had the opportunity to review the 114 entries. The final winner will be announced on Canberra Day next year, and there'll be a public exhibition of all the entries. They're from all around the world, and they include very, very good student entries as well. The point here, though, the reason I raise it here, the themes and the submissions are not dissimilar to the ones that I've just mentioned, and the suite of actions that could underpin an integrated response by cities to climate change. Sustainability is a key focus with emphasis on energy efficiency, biodiversity, healthy cities, and urban resilience to the impacts of climate change. Personally, I was extremely heartened to see that come to the table. On the local scene, right here, there are a number of other very positive initiatives underway, including the current tender process for the largest solar farm in Australia. It's a very, very exciting project. The establishment of the Climate Change Council, which I'm also privileged to chair, with diverse membership to advise the minister, climate scientist, economist, community sector, business sector, urban planner, and senior public servant. That's its strength, its diverse membership. And the many recommendations of the draft climate strategy currently being considered by the ACT government. If we can make a serious and long-term commitment to public transport, active living, retrofit our old commercial building stock, and retain our green spaces for biodiversity and adaptation, then our national capital should be well placed to be a leading example in responding to climate change. We could actually become a solar city. Now, that would be exciting. Just finally, to conclude, this is not business as usual. We will have to do things differently. There are many challenges, and with that, opportunities for cities to tackle climate change. To conclude, I would like to make the following points for consideration and discussion. One, and this is a Fabian interest. Our cities and regions are not level playing fields, and I'm sure you know that as Fabians. Significant social economic differences between and within. The capacity of a population to adapt to climate change will vary according to social, education and economic status. Communities' ability to understand risk scenarios, capability to relocate from one place to another, resilience for rebuilding after disasters will differ. A more integrated regional approach could possibly help here. In fact, I'm sure it could, by better equipping communities in a broader context for social and environmental change, becoming adapted communities. The second, and this just rolls off the tongue so quickly, but any of you from universities will know it's the hardest thing to achieve, interdisciplinary research required for the built and natural environments. Just so easy, isn't it? I don't think so. New partnerships we require for research, government, better linking research, government and the community. And we do have an example here that Will Staffan and I have set up between ANU and University of Canberra called Canberra Urban and Regional Futures. And you can have a look at CURF on the website. It's been going for about a year and a half now, and we're in discussions with the ACT government about trying to have support for its future. So I really recommend it to you. But it is about, it's an example of a new entity that's trying to strengthen these partnerships and cross the boundaries. Thirdly, skills and education on cities and climate change must inform the generation of decision makers. As I said, at least one of my students is here, if not more. Young people from national and international settings will demand both community-based and government responses to climate change adaptation. Examples of this are courses in urban and regional planning at UC, climate change at ANU, and new units such as Cities and Climate Change Winter Term Unit, University of Canberra. I mention that on purpose, not just because that's part of my program, but there is some discussion in some of our new political landscape, let me generalise, that perhaps we shouldn't be teaching such things in our universities. And one notable commentator has attacked me in the past for doing so. So I just, we will continue with strength and get bigger. So, and the partnership between UC and ANU on this, I think, is terrific. Fourthly, cities and green growth. Innovation and research in low-carbon built environments such as green precincts. So not just green buildings, but you could imagine if we look at the whole of Northbourne Avenue as one integrated entity, we may be able to achieve things that we haven't even thought about before. Smart infrastructure, renewable energy precincts, local renewable energy precincts, integrated urban planning again, of course, and I can go on. And then finally, I think, and this is not about more government, I could be accused of saying that, it's about more effective government, or joining the dots, as I've said before, over the long term. Finally, I think we need an Australian Sustainable Development Commission. And your eyes might glaze over and go, oh, not another thing. But I'm serious here. The Sustainable Cities Parliamentary Inquiry in 2005 recommended recommendations one, two, and three to have this. It's an all-party committee. It's the one thing everyone has agreed to. Everyone agreed to it. And it's the one thing we could do. We need a place that can provide advice on these issues, that can join the dots, can have strong relationships with our universities and our research institutions, and also a forum for debate where we can bring some of those warring parties together around the table. So not more government, but more effective government. So just to conclude finally, in this speech I could have focused on the negatives, on the impediments to change and on the political landscape. That's important and very real, trust me. But so are the opportunities. In the Fabian tradition, I have focused instead on the many and varied interventions at the local and regional level leading to incremental and progressive change. The carbon price has provided the economic platform for structural change. There will be new economic opportunities ranging from carbon farming to renewable energy to smart infrastructure. The mayors and councils of our many towns and cities are engaged in innovation, sharing knowledge and making a difference on the ground. Planning for climate change may well need more strategic intervention and transformational change. And with that, our local leaders will need the support of the national government. Tackling climate change is part of a more integrated response to sustainable development. With more collaboration and strategic investment in new economic opportunities of green growth, there is definitely a pathway for a more sustainable future. The choice is ours, and as Fabians, I believe we should be working for that progressive change towards a more sustainable future for our community, our planet, and our future. Thank you for listening, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara. That was excellent. Perhaps I could steal the prerogative of the chair just to ask a very quick technical question. But just
microphone one.
Just a very quick technical question. You talked about integrated planning. Can you just quickly explain a little bit more what you mean by that?
Community radio as well. We've got a press conference. integrated urban planning. Gosh, we teach a whole course on this. integrated urban planning, let me put this simply. Actually, Canberra has a really fine history. You may not think it. If you've just moved to Canberra, you're probably looking for it. But the tradition of planning of Canberra was actually around the primary school and the local shops and being able to walk to those. And I can see some people nodding heads here. So integrated urban planning is about exactly that, integrating land use so it's of community benefit. So we co-locate those activities, reducing journey to work, so there's local shops, local primary school, kids can walk to school, if their parents allow them. And another conversation. And we have those activities, so yeah, those distances are short. It's not complicated, quite hard to achieve. Even the whole local supermarket issue would be an issue that we could talk about there, trying to keep those spaces alive. The role of local shops, I've been thinking hard about the local centres here. I was here in the 90s, and I went to Melbourne for 10 years, and I came back to take this job 2.5 years ago. And I know the history of planning here. The role of those local neighbourhood centres, I think, is so important. And they've been struggling, and I think I'm going to run a design exercise, at least for my students anyway, if no one else is going to do it. What could we do? What are the exciting futures for those neighbourhood centres? And I mentioned hubs, it's just one idea. But I do think they have a role, because if we can get those to work effectively with the community, then I think they'll provide a very strong focus for those communities, particularly in the new areas, I have to say. Yeah.
Can I ask about public transport? No one actually knows how many people catch buses each day in Canberra, but it's probably somewhere between about 20 and 30,000 people, which suggests that's a kind of residual service, isn't it? For the most part, aren't choosing to take buses instead of cars. I think in a lot of cases people can't afford cars or whatever, or children. So I'm just wondering what you see as the future of... I mean, you talked about light rail. But
yes.
I mean, let's face it, it's buses really that are critical at the moment and likely to be critical for the foreseeable future. So I'm just wondering where they fit into all this.
Okay. Look, what you say is real. When you look at that, we could continue to be a car society here. That's a choice, I said. That's our choice. Is that the future we want for Canberra, though? But to make that change, we need to provide a service that people want. When it comes to integrated planning, that means we need to locate employment next to those routes. The advantage of light rail is it's a fixed route. If you look at planning its history, development follows those fixed routes. Employment follows those fixed routes. We actually made a commitment to put light rail down Northbourne Avenue. The industry would say, right, there's a commitment of significant investment in light rail in Northbourne Avenue. Let's invest in that space. So you start to get those co-location of land uses and activities, which is important for that to work. I've heard this argument, and I don't agree with it. I've heard this argument that we don't have the patronage or the population density to support such a system. And usually that comes out of Treasury, actually. It's being recorded. Yes, usually it does come out of Treasury. And yet, if you look at the history of planning, where we go back to our cities, even in Melbourne, as we rolled out the trams and the trains, development, public investment went first, development went second. Right? So I think it's actually a bit of a spurious argument. How we capture, this is a Fabian discussion, how we capture the value added of the rent of those spaces that flank, we're going too quickly, that flank where that public investment goes is actually the key. The one place you can do that with a leasehold system is in Canberra. You can capture betterment of increased land value along spaces where you have investment in public infrastructure. That can pay for it. If we decide to exercise it, that can pay for it. So what was the other question? About buses. Doesn't have to be one or the other. That's the other answer. It can be a network. In fact, I think that's probably the answer in Canberra, that it is an integrated transport network. And in fact, it can almost, there are, I think in Adelaide, you can run a bus and you can run the light rail down the same space. So we can have multimodal as well. So I think we have to think in a more systematic way. More about systems. Systematic way about systems. Yes.
Yeah, well, challenge whether light rail is appropriate technology.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Perth Mandurah.
Yes.
Been like that, very impressive.
Yes.
Trains scream along 130k.
Mm.
Traffic's crawling along on the freeway on either side.
Mm.
Clearly faster than cars. Now, most light rail technology has top speed of 70k.
Mm.
Our buses do 80, 85k.
Mm.
They're already slower than cars.
Mm.
So light rail, put that in, that's slower than buses, which is slower than cars, lose it.
Well,
Canberra is made up of dispersed towns. Well, if you go on the Blue Rapid, down back south, a fair load into Woden. By the time it gets to Southlands, it's nearly empty. It's too far to go by bus at the speed they're going to Tuggeranong. It's a waste of time.
Yeah. Well, it does need a transformation, but I think we're not going to answer these questions until we trial some of these things. And maybe the answer is we have a demonstration of some light rail down here in this city to see whether all those things work or don't work. That's possible.
Yeah, I mean, you find in Northbourne...
Otherwise, we're going to have the same conversation in the next 5 years, you and I, and we're just going to have more cars on the road. That's not a great outcome either.
My concern is that for a 70k light rail on Northbourne Avenue, fine,
and
then extend it down to
Woden,
waste of time.
That's fine. Well, that's your view. Yeah. Okay, next question.
Oh, back.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm studying a Master of Climate Change at the ANU.
Oh, excellent.
And what I'm getting from my studies is that while there's action on, pretty much codified law around the states for sea level rise, as you mentioned, setbacks, etc. Beyond that, there seems to be a preoccupation with adaptation in regards to what I think is an Australian fear about food security, water security. So it tends to be a focus on the rural areas. And beyond that, you know, there seems to be a blind spot in regards to cities, at least at, you know, the high academic and government levels. And I'm glad that you talk about, you know, that there are significant initiatives at the city level. For example, when I looked at climate change, models of climate change impacts on industries, they mentioned, you know, most studies look at industries in rural areas and bugger all in cities, like manufacturing is not touched, you know. Given that, you know, a lot of people don't understand that from a climatology perspective, there's something called an urban heat island. So,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Any changes in climate are going to be magnified by the sort of +5 degrees or whatever it is that all cities have. So, I don't know.
Question?
Can you comment on, you know, this sort of blind spot, if you perceive that?
Actually, I need to be diplomatic here. I think that certainly where you study, there's quite an emphasis on natural resource management. So that's why I think the partnership between ANU and UC has actually got great potential. UC is very much about the built environment, a lot of it, architecture, landscape architecture, building and construction, planning. We've got that whole suite. And FENER and the Climate Change Institute, much more around natural resource management. Which comes to the deeper issue, which I think is right, that we need a much closer connection between natural resource management, non-urban, in many cases, but taught that way, and cities. That is the problem. That's why Africa is a regional approach. When I talk about regions, I take it the same regions as Simon Green. He talks about urban and non-urban, divides the country up into 55 regional communities. So you get those linkages between the urban and the non-urban. I don't think we'll solve those problems until we achieve that. I don't think it's so much a blind spot. I just think it's the way that institutions are structured, catchment management, you know, local government on cities. I just don't think we have, as I said before, like with CURF, we don't have enough institutions or frameworks that help us join those dots. And so I agree with your point very much. But I do think some of us are trying to find better pathways anyway. Yes.
Yeah, I think water-sensitive urban design at the level of suburbs
yes.
already exists that can integrate a lot of the principles of natural resource management
yes.
and urban planning
yes.
or integrated urban planning.
But yes.
unfortunately, in many cases, people only see it as stormwater management, but it's really can be much more than that. It can take into account, you know, the way you dispose of the water from your roofs. You can harvest that. I mean, there's already a lot of incentives for tanks, house storage. But there's also possibilities of doing that at the suburban level with little ponds and green space that also promotes active lifestyles and all sorts of benefits, co-benefits for urban and water management. But I don't see too many developers implementing these techniques.
Some are, actually.
There's a few, but it's not really taking off as much as you would expect, seeing that the techniques already exist.
Yeah. Well, it requires a commitment and a decision to do that. And maybe that's where national government can play a role there. Because certainly some of the leading industries are, some of the leading developers are, both and some of the more progressive councils, and they're working in partnership. A good thing that's happened at the national level under this government is that COAG actually agreed to a set of sustainability principles around cities. And that's now being applied to cities. And a bit like competition policy 10 years ago, the sort of idea is, anyway, that if cities can start to perform on some of these issues, like water-sensitive urban design, then there'll be a dividend that follows. So that always attracts the interests of states. But at the moment, that process is, they've agreed to the principles. But as you know, the political landscape, as I've referred to a few times tonight, has changed at the state level. And when it comes to, I think we're talking about, it's connected, talking about sea level rise policies and having those embedded. Well, they were until about 2 months ago. And the head of the Gold Coast, the new mayor, has just come in, has decided climate change doesn't exist. So sea level rise is going out of there. The amazing, powerful, really. And the and in Victoria, the sea level rise has been reduced from prediction of 0.8 to 0.4 in 2100, just like that. And New South Wales planning is now under review. And also, they're starting to see some street protests in some of those coastal towns about their land. So in theory and in principles are in place, and some policies are really that are very good and have taken 10 years of work to put in place are at risk right now. That's the negative story I didn't tell tonight, but that's the reality.
But maybe one way around that is to convince
yes.
And beneficial to them. That way you bypass the need for legislation and politicians being on board.
Look, this is why I have hope. I talk about cities and cities, regions and regions. I'm serious. That's where I think the innovation will happen. And City of Sydney is doing fantastic work. City of Melbourne is doing fantastic work. City of Adelaide is doing great. I mean, I can go right around this country. And so, and some of the regions as well. So I think that the pressure will come from the ground up. And the links with some of industry and those partnerships at that local level will be where that innovation happens. What I would like to see and see more of here is that a lot of those initiatives to survive need sustained funding over like 5 years to be able to succeed. And we need more of that at the national level. So I think there's hope there, if I paint that. I think there's a lot of hope, but it will come from a different direction. It won't come from top down, it'll come from bottom up. The community will actually demand it. And you're right, the more we can prove that it's cost effective, the better. But not only cost effective, as the picture I painted before, it's good for us. It's healthy cities.
Yeah. Sorry, I think up the back and then...
Sorry, I'm... Sorry. Like everyone in Canberra's had a cold. You can probably hear a bit of residual cold if you still.
I guess picking back on that, in terms of your academic experience and your advocacy experience, how well do you think you and people like you are doing at reframing the conversation? So it's not about climate change, which could be contested for political reasons, but about not just cost effectiveness, but around livability. Just, you know, Melbourne keeps winning all these awards. It's my hometown. I love it.
Yes.
You know, all these sorts of. It's more desirable from an economic and a kind of a political perspective. So instead of saying this is a way of getting your city or your region prepared for climate change, this is a way of saying your city and your region makes a good sea change location, or you know, those sorts of aspects. How well do you think we're doing at changing the conversation?
Okay. I think we've only just begun. Absolutely just begun. I think that Rio was a great opportunity to do that, but that didn't happen on a global scale in the national press. So that was a lost opportunity. There's actually only a few of us who are starting to talk about reframing this in terms of sustainable development. I think there will be more, and I think it's a very positive conversation to have with communities. If I start a conversation about climate change, the kickback against climate change is significant. Work I do in the coasts has shown that at the local level, surveys, it's published work, I can refer you to it. That it's there and it's real and it's significant. However, if you sit down and talk with the community about their future, and in their broad future, economic future, social, environmental, they become very interested, very engaged. So in answer to your question, I think it's a conversation that's just beginning. I think it's a reframing that's just beginning, but I think it has great strength, I hope. Maybe you can all be part of that now.
Getting back to what I guess is the less critical area in a sense, compared to some of the problems on the coast, and that's Canberra.
Yes.
I've been here a long time. You talked about the levels within, you know, we've got a suburb which was originally designed with a school and a small supermarket and two or three shops. Then we've got the intermediate centres out in Belconnen. You've got Jamison, you've got Kibax, etc. And then you've got the Belconnen Mall or whatever it's called.
Sure.
These
town centres.
The town centres. Now we've got those three levels. Now what's happened as they've aged? Now when I came here, you could tell there were 13 or 14 suburbs being built a year and occupied, and you could actually tell when people had arrived in Canberra from the suburb they lived. They occupied this one.
And what level they worked in the public service, too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And anyway, but that's all changed. Mm. Those suburbs have aged. Now, schools have been amalgamated so that no longer is it viable necessarily to have a primary school in each suburb. Mm. You often share them between two or even three suburbs. Mm. Similarly, you've got the larger supermarkets have come in. So you've got, for example, in Jamison, Jamison Centre, you've got the biggest Coles in Canberra at the moment, which has actually had the effect of closing down a little supermarket that was in Miranda, and you've had similar effects elsewhere. So you've got those things closing down. Now the ACT government's done some quite innovative things with some of the primary schools that have been closed down. This is where we get to your idea of community hubs.
Yes.
Now, but you've got another phenomenon in Canberra, and that is clubs. Now, clubs, to a certain extent, are quite like community hubs. They've also got some negative effects, of course, but I think they can be dealt with. But what they do provide is a host of meeting rooms for all sorts of activities.
Sure.
And they're actually very valuable in that respect. And in that respect, they do provide a community facility that is actually quite difficult to provide in community hubs, simply because they don't have the catering facilities on hand.
Right.
Now you can have a meeting or a series of meetings in clubs, and then you can go and get your meal, you can buy a drink or whatever. Now you can't so easily do that in the sort of more artificial community hubs that are created. So I just wonder how that can all be knitted together into a more coherent,
integrated
sort of plan.
Yes. Well, I don't know the answer to that.
No,
I think it's a great question. Maybe Look, you'd have to look at it, but maybe they suit. Maybe different people go to clubs and community hubs, or maybe you need both, or maybe you go at different times of your life. You know, I think of my mother. She turns 90 next year. She lives on Western Port Bay in Victoria. She goes to the library in Hastings, which is a bit of a community hub, does her computer course, thriving, doing all her banking, the whole lot. She's 90 next year. She wouldn't go near a club.
No, but so very negative, I guess, in some ways. But
what I'm saying, but other people would, you know, be to the New South Wales clubs, and, you know, down on the coast, in fact. And people really patch it. All families, everyone goes to those. So it's not my expertise. What I'm saying is that my guess at this point would be that there'd be room for both, and possibly different audiences. But I might be wrong. But it's not. It's a bit like the buses and the I don't think we should look at these things as either or.
Yeah.
Right. Might be some spaces in Canberra that suit clubs, might be some spaces in... Why don't we go and ask the community? I think that was a strong message. Ask the local community what they want. And it's a good place to start. Maybe it's a good place to finish.
I went to a recent talk here in ACT on food sustainability.
Yes.
And one of the speakers said quite graphically that we are really only 7 meals away from total chaos. You say Flemington was one of our other food sources.
There's big storage centres. Yes.
Tsunami.
Yes.
Or, say, a chemical spill from local industrial sort of things around there. We don't really have any capacity to sort of go past 4 days, even, you know, even with or diesel being held up for some reason. Those Woolworths and Coles trucks you see, and Aldi's and everyone else.
It should be on the rail, by the way. Yes, off the rail.
Once they stop, we are close to 7 days away from chaos. But then I also hear Singapore has identified that they needed 8 square kilometres in, you know, Singapore high rise, very compact, 8 square kilometres to actually get much more food sustainability in their area. And they have identified it either on building walls or up on the roofs. They're actually doing it with aeroponics, not actually using any of the land that they've already sterilised, good fertile land. And I worry about the food security issue a lot, because it will mean that if we have a 1 metre or even a you know, some scientists are saying possibly 7 metres water level rise, the fertile deltas will get knocked out. There will be 200 million to 300 million people on the move, not a few thousand boat refugees, but so many people losing their...
Climate change refugees,
land.
For sure.
And I think we're sort of talking about luxuries here in ACT, about, you know, sort of light rails and things like that. We need to be thinking about how we can actually get food out to some of these people who will become climate refugees, whether we like it or not. It's already built in. I'm just wondering how we, as Canberra, the capital of Australia, can actually demonstrate and lead how we can actually achieve some sort of food security, not only for ourselves, but for the rest of the world.
Again, it's a great question. We're spanning quite a few fields here. Food security is it's not my expertise, except that I will say that from a planning perspective, with cities and climate change, clearly, it is. It's an increasingly important issue on the agenda. I hear it frequently now. One thing about Canberra, I actually believe Canberra is going to come into its own. I really do, with some of these changes, because the one thing we have in Canberra is the green spaces in between. It's the one thing we do have that other cities would die for.
And big median strips.
That's right, and big median strips. Indeed. So why can't we use those productively? You know, so good for biodiversity and good for production as well. I mean, that would be very exciting. So community gardens writ large. Mm. Yeah, there's an idea. Yeah. That's what Fabian's about.
So maybe just final...
So I wasn't being... Look, I just don't know the answer, except that we have a structure that allows for it. Okay? Yes. Yes. We also have a wonderful region. Our region is spectacular. Yeah. I drove over the Monero. There you go, because the train doesn't exist. I want the train line from Canberra to Cooma reopened. I said that publicly. I think I said it last time you recorded me saying it again. So the but on Friday, it was blanketed in snow. It was spectacularly beautiful.
So,
just
final question.
Yeah.
Just a question about, I'm new to the city, and I can't help but notice there's a huge amount of new buildings and that seem quite new there, and actually a bit of building going on as well. How much of that building is incorporating the sort of retrofit, the sort of green technology and the sort of green design with it?
Yeah.
And if that's not happening, why is that not happening?
Okay. Actually, there is quite, the planning laws here are requiring green energy components. So we have a star rating, 5, 6, 7. It's been in domestic buildings and it's getting stronger here. New Acton is a good example of applying that technology. The airport development, which should not have happened, say that again, should, but the because it's displaced, not taking away from the fineness of the development, and I don't want to be in trouble with the people at the airport, but it did displace that development and activity from our centres, kind of distorted the whole planning of Canberra, basically. But some of the developments there actually do have state-of-the-art technology as well. So I think we're on the right trend. I think that we can always do better. We have a lot of B and C grade office development in Civic, for example, that is waiting for new investment. So it's more the market itself that has to drive that. So when's someone going to come along to invest in those buildings, to retrofit those buildings? That's where I think the City of Melbourne's got it right. So partnership, so, you know, it's a suggestion the ACT government could look at that model. There was some incentive for those landowners, and there's only a few, not a lot of people own a lot of those places in Civic. So it's locked up in few hands, in fact, in many ways. If we could encourage those people to work in partnership with a financial incentive, maybe everyone would benefit. Everyone would benefit. So yeah, I'd like to recommend that program to the ACT government to look at. Because at the moment, I think that not much will shift. And we could make quite a transformation. Now, Civic's another topic of discussion. We could have a discussion all night on that as well. That needs to change. For the better. It's looking very tired. Yes. Anybody else? You're in charge.
Nominally. Are there any other questions? Any burning questions?
If really quick one.
Yeah, yep, yep.
I think you might have always touched on this a little bit in your answer. I'm interested in the idea of open space or green space, which I think is at the local level perhaps been talked about for decades, but at the national level it tends to be a bit of a more recent concept and a flavour to the sustainable development conversation. You talked about open space for biodiversity and adaptation. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit more on that.
Sure.
And also if you think there's any conflict between sort of urban infill and the use of urban space in the
Ooh. Two excellent questions and probably require quite long answers, but I'll try and keep it short. Adaptation, we talk about space for adaptation. In terms of green infrastructure. So, for example, if we wanted to have a renewable energy precinct system here, we need space to be able to put that in place, actual physical space, to be able to retrofit this area to be able to have that kind of renewable energy flowing through. Right. So that's one. So new actual space for new infrastructure, clean, green energy infrastructure. Solar farms, things like that. Okay, space for adaptation. We also need, if you think, hotter environments, drier environments, heat islands, someone mentioned that before, biodiversity, vegetation, shade, all those things become even more important in a hotter, drier environment. So. But then you raise a really important question, which can be a conflict. If you increase urban density, this is where I love planning, we increase urban density, then maybe you're going to put those open spaces at risk. I don't think that's very likely in Canberra. Every time I see a a park even mentioned that a corner might disappear, there's a massive outrage and protest and defend that space. So we're pretty strong on that. And those who've come from Melbourne, the same thing happens in Melbourne. So I actually think that I phrase it this way. I think the spaces in between need to be green, and that's even more important in the context of climate change. And we can, with good urban design, have medium density, and I didn't say high, medium density, so think of 7-8 stories, it works in Paris, medium density, good urban design, and parks and gardens. They achieve it, I'm sure we can. And I'm not talking about bringing European solutions to Australia, but we can actually learn from them.
Excellent.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you for listening, and thanks for a good discussion.
I think yes. A round of applause for you. And if I could just quickly hijack everyone's attention. Thank you again, Barbara.
Pleasure.
And just very quickly, we have copies. Barbara's brought along copies of her speech, so just grab one from the front if you'd like. And also just a very quick plug for upcoming events. On the 6th of September, we have In Praise of Social Democracy with Dr. Kevin Hickson from the UK, who will be discussing his essay, In Praise of Social Democracy. The debates have started, and very interesting debates and relevant to Australia as well. And in November 2012, we have Dr. Lindy Edwards talking about ideology in Australian politics. And, you know, is it still there? And we all hope it is. And but nonetheless, I also have some Australian Fabians forms, membership forms, for those interested in signing up. And if nothing else, please sign the contact sheet at the back that James is holding up, because that way we'll get you on our mailing list and we can let you know about events coming up. But yeah, otherwise, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for coming. Thanks.